Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. Today we'll consider the memory of Margaret Thatcher. First, though, a mood-setting musical clip from the band Hefner, from a song that anticipated this week's events 13 years ago. Yes, though more guilt-ridden than necessary. Americans can be very pious. There are no street celebrations of the death of Ronald Reagan, and I doubt there will be parties when Dick Cheney moves on either. But what an awful figure Thatcher was. Yes, history is shaped by forces larger than any individual, but there's no doubt that people like her, and Reagan too, count a lot as well. Just a few words before the interview begins. In what follows, you'll hear references to the Winter of Discontent. That was a name given by the right-wing press to a wave of labor militancy in 1979, mostly driven by the rank and file, not the leadership, whose consequences were greatly exaggerated at the time by the tabloids, which were being heavily worked by the Tory publicists. In fact, labor's economic record was nowhere near as bad as it's been portrayed, and the consequences of Thatcher's revolution were nowhere near as good, by conventional measures, I emphasize. By many such conventional measures, British economic performance was worse in the Thatcher years, 1979 to 1990, by the way, than it was in the 1970s. Even honest mainstream commentators have to concede that her legacy is not as impressive as the hype. As Martin Wolf, one of the smartest and most honest in that mainstream, wrote on the front page of the Financial Times the day after she died, "History has not been kind to confidence in a durable British economic resurgence. Today, alas, the post-Thatcher renaissance looks as much illusion as reality." But what Martin Wolf doesn't say is this: Thatcherism made the rich richer and broke the political power of labor in the left, and for that she is revered. My first guest is Tom Mills. Mills is an editor at the New Left Project, an ecumenical website that, in its own words, offers comment and analysis on issues of concern to the political left broadly defined. It's on the web at newleftproject.org. Tom Mills. Welcome, Tom. Let's start by talking about some of the background of Mrs. Thatcher. The kind of small-town grocer's daughter certainly is visible, was visible in her personality. What was her early biography?
The grocer's daughter was, it's true, but it was something that was crafted by her PR advisors in the 1970s. You know? She's remembered as kind of a conviction politician, you know, much more authentic. One of the things that people are saying now, she's passed away, as they miss having an authentic politician who means what she says. But the notion of the grocer's daughter and the simple background was all part of her being crafted in the 1970s when she becomes party leader by her PR advisors. But it was true. She was born in 1925 in Grantham, which is a town in the Midlands in England, fairly ordinary small town. And her father ran, I think, a couple of grocery stores in the town, and he was a lay preacher, so she had a quite conservative background, which she referred to a lot, was seen as a big part of her political personality, you know, thrift and personal responsibility and all that sort of, those things that used to be referred to as middle class values, which she would champion. So that was where she came from. And she left Grantham to go to Oxford, I think, in 1947, where she studied chemistry and spent a period working as a research chemist. And then she moved into politics later on. A significant event for her was when she met her husband, who was a millionaire businessman and divorcee, Dennis Thatcher, who gave her a name. She was born Roberts. So in reality, by the time she becomes a political figure, she was a millionaire oil magnate's wife. But the idea of her being from a simple background, you know, was all part of her populist right-wing appeal. The idea of, you know, coming from humble backgrounds and working hard to make your way up to the top, that was a very important aspect of the whole Thatcher ideology. And she was actually given elocution lessons, so she would sound less well-spoken, as well as more self-assured and told how to dress. And that was actually part of more of a performance than people generally remember.
Yeah, the how to dress business was interesting. What was she supposed to look like?
Yeah, well, she was supposed to look like a no-nonsense, lower-middle-class housewife, you know. So and the mother, and this was all part of the branding of Thatcher in the 1970s. She was one of the first. Well, the prime ministers before had their press advisors, but one of the this was when spin and PR really starts to take off around Thatcher, and she had a couple of very important advisors. One of which was Tim Bell, who works in an advertising company. Another was Gordon Rees. One of the things they did was when she became Conservative leader and for her campaigns was they courted a relationship with the tabloid press. So it was all part of her developing a more sort of homely, everyday sort of image. I mean, which not everyone found very convincing. You know, a lot of people thought of her as a very condescending, posh sort of character. But you know, so some people admired her. I had people on the radio, you know, talking about her coming from working class backgrounds. So that was an important part of her branding.
The Conservative Party of the 1970s was one that had sort of made peace with the unions to some degree and the welfare state. They were not the reactionaries that they would become starting later in the decade, right?
The leading figures in Heath's government, which was when Thatcher first became a cabinet minister, she was education secretary. They were sort of corporatist. There were right wingers in the Conservative Party, but the generation before the Macmillan, who was the prime minister when Thatcher was elected MP, he was very much you know, accepting the welfarist consensus and, like you say, like consulting unions. But Heath, who came to power in 1970, he had a go at breaking with some of that, or at least trying to bring the unions within some sort of corporatist kind of regulation where they'd have to, you know, there would be legal controls over the right to strike and so on. And the Labour government had actually had a go at this in the late 1960s as well, and actually failed when it was essentially vetoed by the left wing of the party. But Heath has another go at this, and he fails essentially. The National Union of Mine Workers go on strike, and Heath backs down. It's questionable really whether he ever really wanted to depart from the welfarist consensus, but I mean certainly there were attempts to take on the trade unions before Thatcher comes into power, even within the Liberals within the Labour Party. So there were those elements. But this is the context which forms Thatcher. So Heath takes on the unions and he does his famous U-turn and he kind of backs down and withdraws all of his attempts to move Britain in a right-wing direction. And he's essentially forced from office by the National Union of Mine Workers, and Labour come to power. And it's in opposition, in the crisis of Heath's leadership, that Thatcher comes to the fore with the ascendant New Right, which included, you know, conservative moralists and neoliberals and cold warriors, the Christian right as well, which weren't nearly as potent a force as they were in the United States. But all these kind of elements were there, reacting to particularly to the new left, you know, the countercultural stuff, trade union power, and it was kind of exasperated by the economic crisis, huge inflation. So there was this great sense of crisis in Britain in the 1970s, and Thatcher sort of, you know, she tries to galvanise all of that right-wing discontent, and as she comes to lead the Conservative Party and becomes under the influence of neoliberalism, which is, you know, in Britain still is referred to more often as Thatcherism. You know, it's free market ideas and so on. You know, so much did she define neoliberalism here.
And there was a great intellectual mobilization of the right, like the Mont Pelerin Society, which it was founded decades before, but became relevant in a political way that it hadn't been earlier.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, the Mont Pelerin Society, well, members of it had been quite active here. I mean, Hayek was here for a while, and the key people were associated with the Institute of Economic Affairs, and they had done pamphleteering, and they had some, you know, they had some sympathizers. The Tory right were never really very comfortable with this notion of, you know, the welfare state and union power and so on, and all the things that the post-war consensus, essentially. But most of them didn't think it was viable to overturn any of these things, because they just accepted that, you know, in order to win elections, you have to agree with these things, and particularly because the Labour Party had won on such a huge landslide in 1945, and that was against Winston Churchill, you know, sort of a national giant. So these were kind of ingrained within the Conservative Party, but the neoliberals, you know, they very skillfully try and manipulate the crisis of the 1970s, particularly inflation, which, you know, really alarmed a lot of people, and particularly, I mean, Conservative supporters didn't like it because it ate into their savings, but the banks didn't like it either because it undermined the value of the pound. So, you know, the two sort of elements of the Conservative power didn't like inflation, and that kind of sense of crisis that builds up gets manipulated by the neoliberals. So Thatcher starts a think tank with Keith Joseph, who became the leader of the right-wing sort of anti-Heath faction in the Conservative Party. And he went around Britain giving speeches about how the problem was economic decline was caused by the unions and excessive public spending and poor morals and so on. And he tried to bind together a sort of populist, right-wing, anti-welfarist program, which Thatcher then runs with, because Keith Joseph has to step out of the leadership campaign and challenge the Heath, Thatcher's predecessor, because he makes some ill-judged comments about basically poor people breeding too much, and he leaves, and then Thatcher steps in. It's a big surprise that she ends up winning the ballot, and she wins the first ballot, but often the case of these things, you know, the first person who goes in to sort of get rid of the old leader doesn't end up leading, but it's kind of a surprise when she comes in 1975. But she had founded a think tank called the Centre for Policy Studies, and essentially that was a new liberal outfit to try and convert the Conservative Party to you know, free market ideas. And with Heath, she was converted to this notion that the free market was the way forward, and she kind of blends together free market ideas with, you know, very strong anti-communism and a kind of a feeling of Britain being in decline. And of course, you've got to remember this is kind of a post-imperial kind of moment as well, so there's all this kind of anxieties in certain parts of British society about British power waning with decolonization and stuff like that. So she leads a sort of right-wing, chauvinistic, nationalist, fairly sexist kind of movement, and the neoliberals are part of that. And it's really only later that, you know, it becomes clear that it's neoliberalism really that's the most at the centre of Thatcher's politics. In the 1970s, you know, she was just seen as an authoritarian populist was the phrase that was often used, you know.
I'm speaking with Tom Mills, who is one of the editors of the New Left Project and an author of a piece on that site that surveys the career of Margaret Thatcher. Often here in the United States, even coming from, you know, liberal Democrats, that the unions were out of control and something had to be done, and we may not like it, but she did what was necessary. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, it's a very popular opinion here, but it's I think it's based on a lot of misunderstandings about the 1970s, and this has been very useful for the Thatcherites to portray the 1970s in this way, and you hear it now. You know, it's one of the things which if you try and do something in British politics, like, you know, control wages or something like that, you're going back to the 1970s, or it's kind of a scare thing. But, you know, it was a time of genuine economic difficulty. There was high rates of inflation. But one of the things that gets quite misunderstood is firstly, the role that the Labour Party actually played in that, and secondly, where the unions fitted into that. And what happened actually wasn't the way it's commonly imagined. The hyperinflation starts under Heath. Heath deregulates the banks and makes some important steps towards free market finance that causes huge inflation. Inflation is actually brought down quite significantly by the Labour government, and the technique they use for this is to essentially go into a deal with the unions. Keith having essentially been forced from office by the unions, the Labour come in as they're seen as the party that can bring Britain back to prosperity by getting the unions on board. So they do a deal with the unions. It was called the social contract, and the idea was you'd have wage restraint in return for sort of concessions to the to the left of the Labour movement. So you had a quite strong left-wing government, which is not back in pretty much by the IMF and by right-wingers in the party. When Callaghan comes to power, he's also influenced by neoliberalism. It says you can't spend your way out of recession, so it kind of brings an end to a very short flirtation with Keynesian ideas. And what happens is they essentially have very strict wage controls on union members. So the Labour Party, you know, supposedly the party of the workers, ends up driving down the living standards of its own voters, its own base. And there's a decline in living standards. And basically, Labour just almost too successful. They go too far. Callaghan in 1978, goes through asks for another period of wage restraint after the longest period of decline in wages since the 1930s, I think. He calls for more wage restraint, and everything just breaks. Because what happened was, you know, they had these guidelines on under the social contracts that you shouldn't have any wage awards above a certain amount. This was part of their counter-inflationary policy. And it's broken with a wage of strikes, basically, in protest to the Labour government's pay policy. And that's what happened shortly before the election. James Callaghan, who by then is the leader of the Labour Party, is in office. And Thatcher essentially seizes the moment. The right-wing press has by this point become a very potent force in British politics. They attack the government as being sort of held to ransom by the unions, and this has been a very stubborn myth in British politics. I mean, it doesn't describe what actually happened, but they were very good at manipulating events in a certain way and capitalising on them, and that's the circumstances which Thatcher comes to power. You know, we've kind of a sort of a mandate for reform, but she didn't campaign on any of the stuff which we now associate with Thatcherism, you know, in privatization, confronting union power especially. It was mainly negative campaigning, attacking the Labour Party. Actually, she was portrayed as a quite homely sort of figure in the 1979 election campaign, and she goes into to Downing Street promising to bring peace rather than conflict, you know, which proved quite ironic.
And then, of course, quite the opposite happens, though certainly with some help from Volcker and Reagan across the Atlantic, but a very deep recession ensues. May or may not have been designed as such, but it did have tremendous economic and political effects.
Yeah, well, their counter-inflation policy, obviously they couldn't rely on partnership with the unions, and they choose they turned to monetarism as their solution, which was the idea was they would, you know, cut down on the money supply, although the way they do it is kind of criticized actually by some monetarists. The value of the pound causes this essentially a huge collapse in manufacturing because exports become uncompetitive. Unemployment goes up to eventually to 3 million from 1 million under Labour, which was again ironic because she had one of the posters, the famous poster she had campaigned on was Labour's not working. It was a picture of a donkey, and there's riots in the inner cities. And by this point, Thatcher is, you know, she's the most unpopular prime minister in history. It's just turned around with a bit of luck from the Falklands War and through a relative economic recovery, which could, you know, make just enough voters feel a bit better, and probably most of all by a divided opposition. The Labour Party splits into the Social Democratic Party. A lot of the right wing of the party, who don't want to be associated with the unions anymore, try to form a sort of, you know, midway liberal party. We don't really have a liberal party in this country. I mean, we do, but they then later teamed up with the Social Democrats to form an electoral alliance. So she wins the second term after the Falklands War.
And then the other part of her her policy heritage that gets some applause over here is the privatizations, which were regarded as necessary and had only good outcomes from the mythology you hear here. What about that?
These are said to have been improvised in office, the idea of privatizations. Again, she didn't really campaign on the idea at all. This was she comes in after a second term in office with a huge... Much more comfortable majority in Parliament than she had before, and quite determined to make some profound changes. And she drives through these privatisations. So we had these public utilities, gradually are all sold off around the time of of the Big Bang. And of course, the idea was, or the theory was, that this would create competitive markets for provisions of service. You know, consumers could choose where to buy their gas or electricity, or, you know, eventually the railways are privatized as well. The other element of it was trying to persuade people to buy into, you know, to capitalism and free markets and so on, shareholding democracy and all that sort of stuff. You know, in reality, they were quite a mixed bag in terms of how popular they were, but they certainly never operated as markets in any serious way. And, you know, some of them were actually famously corrupt. I mean, the railways, although actually it was John Major, Thatcher's successor, who privatized the railways, and they still receive public subsidies. They just happen to now provide profits for private companies. And it's a similar sort of story with the gas. We have repeated parliamentary reports criticizing the big five energy companies, which are raking these huge profits, you know, and keep pushing up gas prices for consumers. And, you know, this is the reality. You can't have a consumer market for public utilities. That was the whole rationale for introducing public utilities in the first place, you know, that you'd have a publicly owned infrastructure, which would then be useful for business and for the population. But the reality is that, of course, what you got with Thatcherism behind all of the rhetoric about the free market was actually, you know, state-supported big business. I mean, a good example of that is something which you're hearing more talked about here than the privatizations of the utilities is the council houses. The Thatcher government, one of the most popular policies was that they sold off council houses at subsidized rates. So, you know, you could buy your house cheaply if you're in public housing. But of course, this was an example of a state subsidy to the financial sector, essentially, and the housing market. So you had a huge housing bubble as a result. So in London, where I live, no one can afford to buy a house. And you know, you had massive asset inflation as well. So these were the reality of the policies, you know, behind all of the rhetoric about empowerment and markets and so on. It was really about money, and particularly the City of London, which was very well placed to profit from all of the changes that Thatcher introduced. And, you know, I would argue was behind all of the, you know, all this talk about hard work and discipline and morality and so on. You know, it was the banks that really benefited from Thatcher's time in power, not really anyone else, not even the small business people who she loved to go on about.
And then finally, the state of Britain's economy today is just a wreck, certainly one of the weaker ones in the developed world. It looks like that she didn't really leave behind much of a transformed foundation. The manufacturing got savaged during her reign, and it's really hard to see what the dynamic foundations of the British economy are today. I mean, what is her heritage 20-some years after she left office?
Well, you know, I think it depends how you look at it. I mean, she did leave a very strong economic foundation. If you happen to be a banker, she left you in quite a good position. They've not really suffered at all from the crash. But I think, yeah, I mean, in terms of certainly at the level of rhetoric and, you know, economic competency and so on, it's really only in 2007, 2008 where the whole, you know, notion of Thatcherite free market economics and all this sort of stuff really comes dramatically unraveling. But, you know, a lot of people debate about the economic competency of the Thatcher years, but I think in some way this is kind of a distraction, you know, because it assumes that actually what the Thatcherites were interested in was establishing a strong economic base for the majority of the population, and it's quite clear that wasn't actually a huge priority for them. If it was a huge priority, they wouldn't have allowed British manufacturing to wither in the way it has, and they wouldn't have squandered North Sea oil in the way that they had. There's a lot of ways you can criticize Thatcherism for its economic record, but I think you know, fundamentally, on some level, this disguises or avoids what I think is the fundamental truth that lay under Thatcherism, which was that she talked the small business talk, but she walked the big business walk. You know, she was a wife of a millionaire, and all her friends are millionaires, and I think, you know, she did set a good economic base for them. We saw what happened with the financial crash. I mean, on a national level, sure, it was disastrous, but seen from a sort of a class perspective, they got their bailout, just like everyone else in the Thatcher years.
I was Tom Mills, an editor at the New Left Project, newleftproject.org, an author of a piece on that site that's an excellent overview of the Thatcher legacy. You're listening to KPFA and KPFB in Berkeley, KFCF in Fresno, and on the web to kpfa.org. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. A Son of Abernant by the Mekons, a dark song of defeat in a miner's voice. Abernant is a town in Wales at the site of a mine that closed during the Thatcher years. Next up is Richard Seymour. Richard Seymour runs the blog Lenin's Tomb and is the author most recently of Unhitched, The Trial of Christopher Hitchens. Here he is to parse Thatcher's relationship to the British class system. Let's talk first about the grocer's daughter. I mean, that was part of her mythology of who she was. She emerged from the provincial petty bourgeoisie. How much truth is there to that?
Oh, there's some truth in that. I mean, her father was a liberal politician who owned a couple of grocery stores. She lived in the flat above one of them, and she strove very hard in her education. She achieved a lot, and she got a scholarship to Oxford, only after somebody else had been rejected. So she is somebody who would see herself as a striver in Cameron's terms. And that petty bourgeois background, I would say, influenced her political language, and it gave her a certain common touch which was lacking on much of the right.
But then she had the good fortune to take up with a millionaire.
Oh, yeah. Well, there you go. And also that she invented an accent for herself, a sort of more authoritarian, I don't know what you would call it. I guess it's much more posh than the sort of received pronunciation that you get in the BBC. So, yeah, there was so much about her that reeked of upward class mobility and constant striving and aggression to get there.
I was in London in 1981, and I remember reading an editorial in the Times, pre-Murdoch Times, that was making fun of her bogus Belgravia accent.
Oh, yeah.
What was the Times saying by that?
Well, I mean, again, she came from provincial Manchester. Her accent wouldn't have been a sort of Belgravia one. The harsh, clipped tones that she developed came later. It was partly a result of her upward class mobility and also partly a result of a political calculation. She started off speaking in a fairly mild voice, but actually they found that it worked better for her to adopt a much sterner and more choppy accent, if you like. So it was part of a performance, part of who she was supposed to be as a politician. But yet, at the same time, I insist she maintained what politicians sort of cloyingly refer to as a common touch, and that was quite effective.
And she was heavily invented and reinvented, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at her and her development, she wasn't the natural leader of the Tory right. She was not considered a particularly charismatic person. She was an intellectual, but she wasn't considered an intellectual leader in the way that Keith Joseph was. And Keith Joseph was really the leader of the new right before Mrs. Thatcher took over. And the reason why Mrs. Thatcher took over was because Keith Joseph made an ill-judged speech in which he called effectively, I think, for eugenics for the lower classes. And these sorts of prejudices, incidentally, haven't disappeared from the Conservative Party. Howard Flight made a speech or a statement a few years ago in which she complained that the welfare state was encouraging births among the lower classes. So, anyway, that cost him any chance of the leadership. Mrs. Thatcher came to the fore. And she was able to, as I say, communicate in a language that, a very traditionalist language that ordinary people could recognize. For example, rather than speak in the sort of abstract doctrines of neoliberal political philosophy that she was educated in, she would explain things like, you know, you can't spend more than you've got in the kitty. So the state was interpreted as if it was a corner shop, like her father's. You know, that's the kind of language that was made it possible to convert really weirdly abstract doctrines of the market into a popular common sense.
American politicians talk that way all the time. Is this unusual for British politicians to talk with that common touch?
I would say it was unusual. Let me put it like this. The Conservative Party struggled to develop a common touch for very good reasons. Until 1965, the leadership was selected by what was called a magic circle, which was a bunch of people who were in the party's elite, the establishment, who discussed and negotiated and wheeled and dealed behind closed doors and usually picked a very posh member of the establishment to lead the party. And they could be very sort of contemptuous of the Conservative base. Mrs. Thatcher was the second leader of relatively modest origins after Ted Heath. And really until David Cameron, they had to keep picking people from that sort of background. Cameron is the first genuine top they've had leading them for a while, which says something about the changing cultures of class in this country, changes that Mrs. Thatcher helped achieve, incidentally.
Yes, I do want to get to that point. But talk about the Conservative Party she entered. What was its ideology? What was its class base, regional base?
Well, it was undergoing a profound change and crisis when Mrs. Thatcher took over. I mean, traditionally, the Tories had a lot of working class areas, certainly since the late 19th century. For example, Scotland was traditionally Conservative right up until the 50s. Birmingham, lots of it was Conservative. Anywhere where there was a question of religious politics in particular, unionism versus Irish republicanism, sort of being involved with that, the Tories could make headway. But the sort of cultural and political homogenization imposed by, I guess you would call it, in the outdated terms, monopoly capitalism, led to a breakdown of those kinds of politics, and Scotland turned Labour in the 1950s. Most of these working class heartlands turned Labour, and by the mid 1970s, the Conservative Party's base was narrower than it had ever been. I think Ted Heath stood for election in 1974, the second election, 74, and won about 35% of the vote. Which wasn't a sustainable electoral base. The other thing to say is the nature of the base that they had been working with. In the post-war period, they had managed to hold on to a large number of working-class votes on the basis of accepting the welfare state. You know, essentially it was the idea that the pollsters told them, if you want to maintain a chance of getting an office again, after Labour's radical reforming government of 1945 to 51, you have to win over not just the lower middle class, which is your traditional popular base, but is shrinking, but also a section of the skilled working class. And they were really the first sort of ones to respond to polling data. So they accepted the welfare state and everything that came with it, and even expanded it in some ways. And basically their message was conservatism is nothing other than paternal socialism. And this is what Harold Macmillan claimed. And you've never had it so good. So continue to vote conservative and things will continue to get better. What Mrs. Thatcher did was take up some of the lead offered by Enoch Powell, because Enoch Powell noticed that you didn't have to offer a welfare state to get popular support. There were the politics of race and nationalism. And interpreting things through the prism of Britishness in particular, and a white notion of Britishness, you could articulate a politics of a free market, of competitive struggle, but codified in the language of making Britain strong again, getting rid of the immigrants, making the pound strong, and dealing with the various malcontents and enemies within. So the class basis of the Conservative Party altered slightly in that after the crisis of the 1970s, Mrs. Thatcher was able to recover a degree of support in the sort of skilled working class, and also increasingly to win over male workers, because previously the Conservatives' base had been pronounced sort of female voters, and that was breaking down. One other change that took place in the Tory base was the decline in support for the Conservatives in the professional middle class, which went overwhelmingly to the Liberals or to Labour, and that's still the case today.
The rhetoric of free markets and competition and rewards and punishment and all that appeal to a strain of American Protestantism. Is there something similar in British culture that gives that kind of thing a popular appeal?
Well, of course there is a certain history of Protestantism and the sort of work ethic culture in this country. But, you know, I would say that that was just capitalism. To me, that's a capitalist culture. I have not asked anybody and been told no when I've asked that. If you decide to take a day off work, do you feel guilty? If you decide to turn into work late, do you feel guilty? People really do buy into the idea that work is a source of value, not just you know, economic value, but value as a human being. And to not be working is to not have basic respectability. And that has been a strong component in British popular culture for a long time. And it's been accentuated in the years since the Thatcher Revolution, which is why it's so easy to attack, for instance, welfare claimants.
I'm speaking with Richard Seymour, who is the keeper of the Lenin's Tomb blog. Okay, now let's move on to her ascension to power. The standard story is that the British population was disgusted by the excesses of the unions and the winter of discontent, and they welcomed the whip of discipline coming from Mrs. Thatcher. What truth is there to this construction?
There's some truth in it, but it's important to recognize, A, the fact that there was a very large number of workers, in fact, most workers, who didn't vote Conservative. And the Tories won a plurality throughout the 1980s, around 40 to 44%, but never a majority. That's one thing. The second thing is the extent to which this experience of the winter of discontent was constructed politically and ideologically. There's an interesting article, I say interesting, these are relative terms, but in the journal Parliamentary Affairs, which is thrilling, I assure you, and it basically describes how the winter of discontent, the experience of it, was constructed through mass media representations, through political representations. In effect, while the Labour Party was moving to the right, was embracing monetarism, was embracing public spending cuts to appease the IMF, was de facto massively reducing incomes for the vast majority of working people, in spaces that were created by Labour's retreat from its traditional Keynesian corporatist agenda, the Thatcherites moved in, and what they said was that your experience of privation and social breakdown and violence and chaos is actually caused by creeping collectivization. You know, nobody wants a dictatorship, nobody wants some sort of Stalinist regime, but effectively you start with the idea of everybody has to pay in the same, the state has to provide everything for you as if you were a child, and in the end you find that the state's power keeps growing and growing, and it becomes quite oppressive. And the unions are a part of this sort of collective agenda. And that is how they managed to interpret people's real experiences as a crisis brought on by, you know, rampant trade unions and collectivism in the political establishment. So there was a real populist element to it. It didn't have to work out that way, of course, because it was, you know, I mean, it was a question of political struggle. It just so happened that the Labour Party really had nothing to offer by way of contrast except for a qualified and partial and retreating defence from the post-war consensus.
Now, what do you make of Stuart Hall's argument that Thatcher successfully transformed the common sense of the British public?
Stuart Hall's very interesting because he anticipated many of the developments of Thatcherism and many of the ways in which they would attempt to transform the common sense. But he was also sensitive enough to notice that in many respects, the Thatcherite agenda didn't actually win over the mass of people. In some ways it did. But when it came to things like public services, welfare, and so on, actually Mrs. Thatcher alienated large numbers of people. What really shifted opinion, and Hall has recently written about this, is the fact that Labour started to adopt Thatcherite ideas and interpret them in a language that was acceptable to Labour supporters, to the core working class, who had previously been invulnerable to these ideas. Also, not to overstate this, there's also the growth of a very large number of people who really are just disoriented, don't know what they think. I noticed that when you look at the polls, for example, around redistribution, what tends to happen is not that there's a massive growing opposition to redistributing wealth, but actually there's a very large growth of the number of people who don't know what they think. And that is in large part because the major party of the organised working class, the Labour Party, and the traditional party of welfare supporters is not giving any lead on this, and is, if anything, internalising and accepting Thatcherite ideologies. So, like I say, there are strong elements of truth to Hall's claim. I would say, though, that he was part of a general tendency, the sort of Euro-communist wing of the British left, which overstated the extent to which Thatcher would sort of transform the common sense. And not so much Hall, but there was a general argument that Thatcherism was going to destroy the Labour Party, was going to destroy the trade unions, that it was a threat to parliamentary democracy, almost akin to fascism, and that therefore there needed to be a sort of popular front-style response like the 1930s. I think, in retrospect, they were profoundly wrong about that. Thatcher didn't want to break the unions or the Labour Party. She wanted to break the left wing and the militants.
Now, you said earlier that she transformed the class system. How did she do that? In what ways?
Okay, so she didn't start it. And, you know, Thatcherism is a name for processes that actually begin before Thatcher. But she certainly carried them out to a significant extent. So, first of all, breaking up the traditional bases of support for organized labor by deliberately shutting down large sections of industry and repivoting the British economy on a services basis, unleashing the financial sector and really strengthening the institutional bases of a certain type of class power, ruling class power, through the Bank of England, through the investment banks, the hedge funds and the, you know, just the City of London in general. And secondly, there was the offshoot of that for a section of the middle class and some skilled workers, which was that because Mrs. Thatcher privatized housing, basically she said to people in council housing, you have a right to buy. It built in a number of incentives into this because she made it very cheap to buy your house, but it was very clear that because they were rationing house building, there would be a constant pressure on prices to move upwards. And with the unleashing of the financial markets, that meant that a large number of people could continually borrow against the soaring value of their homes and support consumption that way. So she made it so that you were a mug if you didn't buy into these basically sort of neoliberal individualist solutions to your problems. And she made it much more difficult for you to pursue a collective solution through, I don't know, trade union struggle, through political activism and so on and so forth. One other effect was to change the nature and the mode of class domination, I think, which basically is the hollowing out of representative democracy. I mean, you know, there's no point in buying into the notion of golden age, because there never was a golden age. The system in the 50s and 60s was always very paternalist and top-down, but there was a sense in which segments of the population were genuinely represented, if not necessarily represented in the way that people on the left would like. What Mrs. Thatcher did was take elements of the state which were representative and transfer them to sort of quangos, to private sector organizations, or just to the functioning of sort of civil servants operating on the basis of public choice economics, you know, introducing market mechanisms into the public sector. So that essentially it became more and more difficult for the population to make any sort of inroads through the existing state. So really profound changes, and changes that, as I say, were continued under New Labour and deepened and accelerated. One of the major differences between people's experiences today and what they might have been 15 years ago, for example, is the dramatic escalation and expansion of areas in which you experience your relationships with everybody else through market mechanisms. You know, what you would once have claimed as a right and as a collective entitlement, you now pay for. And, you know, the sort of degeneration of the trade union movement and of political organization on the left has continued as a result of that. So really profound changes on all levels.
Okay, now let's fast forward since we're running out of time and skipping over about 20 years of history. But in what sense is Cameron her heir or not?
Well, I think he is her heir in the specific sense that Thatcherite ideology and praxis was built into the state. And Thatcherite statecraft colonized the British parliamentary system, such that the only sort of real option for any statesman today who wants to continue to develop British capitalism and to maintain sort of class rule is to further and deepen sort of Thatcher's basic policy orientations. He's not her heir in the sense that he and the people that he is surrounded with are actually very weak politically and very weak ideologically. They are not the sorts of people that Thatcher surrounded herself with, who were, to a large extent, self-made men, as it were, who had been galvanized by the defeats inflicted on Heath by the union movement in the early to mid-1970s. Those devastating blows really radicalized them to the right and made them determined to beat and confront the labor movement. And they were really political killers. They sensed weakness. They hunted it out. They isolated it and they attacked. And they had nothing but unqualified success. Cameron is winning, but not really because of the strengths of himself or his allies in the Conservative Party, but more because of the weakness of the left and because the state apparatus itself, the senior civil service, are doing a lot of the work for them. Everybody who gets elected these days is to some extent an heir of Thatcher and is continuing Thatcher's legacy. But these aren't the hard men who bruised us in the 1980s. And if we could in some way get it together, I'm convinced that it wouldn't take as much as we think to actually land a serious defeat on them.
And finally, the British economy today looks really very weak, and the claims that were made for the sound reconstruction of the thing under Thatcher look really now quite overblown. I mean, is what is left of the British economy at this point? It looks like a frail thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to see anything they're doing as rational if what you're looking for is GDP growth, or even just a restoration of domestic profitability. But I think there's a sort of recognition that eventually some geographical or social sector of production will renew dynamism. I mean, it might not happen next year. It might not happen in the next 5 years. But there will be sort of some sector of the global economy which will open up a space for renewed dynamism, just as Southeast Asia did in the sort of early 1980s and totally turned around the global economy. So I think they're really preparing the way for the British capitalist class to embark on a massive round of expansion once that opportunity opens up. One of the things that's noticeable, actually, is that British employers aren't massively laying people off at the moment, and they haven't been for a few years. They did initially make about 1.5 million additional people unemployed, but they started to rehire them again very quickly. And one of the reasons for this is because they're anticipating that growth will resume, and they don't want to have to go through the hassle of retraining and rehiring. So they have conducted their attack on the basis of reducing wages and hoping to sustain profitability that way. And in fact, if you look at that, of all new income that was added to the British economy over the last few years, you find the vast majority of it has gone to profits. I mean, they've been overwhelmingly successful in those terms. So although, according to certain sort of technocratic measurements of the economy, things aren't looking very good, of course the system has a lot of pathologies built into it. For those that it's intended to benefit, it has actually done the job so far.
That was Richard Seymour, keeper of the Lenin's Tomb blog and author of The Liberal Defense of Murder, an excellent history of the soft left's support for imperial war, and most recently of Unhitched, the trial of Christopher Hitchens. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Let's go out with this, some of another Mekong song, this one in a totally different spirit from the defeated one of Abernant. This is a hymn to Robin Hood that borrows some lyrics from Shelley's Mask of Anarchy. Till next week, bye.
Republican vision, symbolic and explicit. A history of resistance, denied by bishops, lawyers, spies. And Grantham, hugely petty, riding on her crocodile. Cross-keening London Bridge, paved with blood and gold. Ride!